I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, regular listeners, you may have spotted that we've changed our name. It's now Honey & Co. The Food Sessions.
So if you hear this sound, it's just us making dinner.
Well, that and the fact that we're not allowed to use our old title anymore.
It's just been a bit of a thing, but don't worry about it.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Today, instead of having someone to chat to in front of an audience, we actually went to the British Library. We went there with Polly Russell and Rosie Sykes, and we sat reading some of the oldest manuscripts about cookery books in the library.
Yeah, the oldest cookery book in the English language, which is called Form of Curry. And we set about doing an evening of food cooked from that book. Rosie Sykes adapted the recipes from Form of Curry.
And from a couple of other old cookbooks.
We were kind of there doing prep and cleaning and running around mostly. It was Rosie and Polly's show. But we managed to record them, and we hope you'll enjoy it.
For those of you who don't know, Polly Russell is a food historian. She's one of the smartest, funniest people we've met. She's a joy, and she talks about these books and about the food with such passion. Have a listen to kind of a little lecture about it, but it's really fascinating.
Hello, and welcome to this evening's event, History Cooked, in collaboration with Street Child United as part of the Cambridge Food Festival. My name is Polly Russell, and some of you may know that I write a column for the Financial Times called History Cook. This History Cooked evening is being done in collaboration with Rosie Sykes, a wonderful chef and author of Sunday Night Suppers. Rosie and I have been friends for more years than I care to remember, and over those years we've been talking about food and cooking food and sharing a love of food history, and it occurred to us last year that we really ought to get on with bringing those things together to create an informal supper club which used books or menus or ideas of food from the past in order to provide an opportunity to think about food as a lens to thinking about history. And so this evening's event of History Cook is the second one that we've run, and we're so thrilled to be doing it in collaboration with Honey & Co, with Itamar and Sarit. It seems fitting that this evening's menu is based on a manuscript called The Form of Curry, because this is our first History Cooked, and The Form of Curry is the first cookery manuscript written in the English language. It's also probably the most important cookery manuscript as well. So plenty of firsts there. And it's also really fitting that we're working and collaborating with Itamar and Sarit, because they are two of the most exciting voices in food. And I think since they opened their shop in Warren Street and have been writing about cookery and food and sharing with British people their style of cooking, they have really opened out how we understand Middle Eastern food and food from that region. And I hope what will become apparent is that this document that we're basing this evening on, The Form of Curry, which dates back to 1390, 700 years, has so many echoes and links with the food that Itamar and Sarit have championed and made so popular. So the way this came about was that Itamar, Rosie, Sarit and I met at the British Library, and we pored over a whole series of books and manuscripts, and in the end determined a menu based on this one manuscript, The Form of Curry. So I think there are a couple of things to say about The Form of Curry. The first is the title. Curry does not refer to curry. So anyone here who's under the Miss Upranch and they're going to have curry is going to be disappointed. Curry is actually spelled C-U-R-Y, and it refers to cooking. So form of curry means the method to cook or the way of cooking. And the second thing I'd like you to do before we talk about the manuscript or its history is just for you to visualise it. It's stored in the British Library in our most secure vault. So you think like the Lindisfarne Gospels, the Magna Carta, that's who it sits among. And it's kept in a small rectangle blue box, which is very sort of stiff and rather formal and hard to open. So it sort of forces you to slow down before you even start to even get to this manuscript. And the manuscript itself is quite extraordinary. It's 5.8 metres long. It's about 30 centimetres wide. And it's a vellum scroll, so calfskin scroll. So it unfolds in this incredible way. It takes up, you know, tables and tables. And despite the fact that it is 700 years old, it's incredibly clear. The ink on it is totally vibrant. It's black ink. The different sheaths of the vellum are sewed together with a blue thread, which is incredibly bright and vibrant still. The recipes are really readable, particularly as you move down the scroll, because the first half of the scroll is the part of the scroll that's been the most looked at for obvious reasons. But as you move down, it gets more and more clear. There's something to be said, I think, about the form of this manuscript, the fact that it is this huge roll, and that suggests that it's not a recipe book or a record in the way that we would use a recipe book. I mean, first of all, most people that would have been working in the kitchens of Richard II, who was the king at the time, would have probably been illiterate. You would not be able to use this as a recipe book. So this is much more a record. This is much more something that's providing evidence of something. It's maybe an aid memoir, but really it's a bit like the pipe rolls in the Exchequer. This is something that is recording and detailing something about a very successful, very opulent monarch's court. This is what the oldest manuscript in the English language. And I think what you take away from it is that on the one hand, how sophisticated and complex the cooking was in the court at that time, but also how there are so many links with things that we, flavours and tastes and ways of cooking that we have today. So this is the first document to mention olive oil, the first one to mention mace and also cloves. And this is absolutely a document about a royal court. This is not the food that ordinary people were eating. We have very scant evidence for what people were eating before the 14th century. There are some sort of records of menus and of household accounts going back to the 12th century. And from those, we can see that the food that's in the form of curry, the recipes that are in the form of curry, were also being eaten perhaps back as far as the 12th century. So things like hen stewed in cumin, fish boiled in wine, we've got recipes for those back to the 12th century. And so actually, this document, the form of curry, it doesn't just take us back 700 years, it really takes us back 1,000 years. So we're looking back into 1,000 years of history. So when you unroll the document, which you have to do very carefully under the BDI of a manuscripts curator, there's the first part of it is a listing of the recipes. There are 196 recipes in total, and they are listed out almost like a recipe book would be today. So in that sense, it is reminiscent of a cookery book. And then there's an introduction, and the introduction is penned by the chief master cook of Richard II. And it says, I'll just read you some of it. It says, first, it teacheth a man for to make common potages and common meats for a household as they should be made, craftily and wholesomely. Afterwards, it teacheth for to make curious potages and meats and subtleties for all manners of states, both high and low. And the teaching of the form of making of potages and meats, both of flesh and of fish, both set here by number and by order. So this is a little table here showing will teach a man without tarrying to find what meat that him lust for to have. So this is it's stating that this is a sort of practical handbook and a guide for creating what they call sort of ordinary food, but also feasts. But actually, yes, there are real foods, which is like soups and sort of quite simple rice dishes. But actually, this is very much the food of the wealthiest people in society. It's incredibly extravagant. And that is because in the Middle Ages, food is absolutely central to kings, nobles, aristocrats displaying their wealth and displaying their skills, their hospitality, their generosity. It is a form of power, a display of power. And that really goes right up into the late 17th century. In a way, it's sort of real conspicuous consumption. This record is, in a sense, the sort of, it's like the oligarch's yacht of today. It's evidence that Richard II is sophisticated, that he has a huge amount of money to spend. We know that his court was particularly lavish and opulent, that he used art, culture, ritual as being very important to maintaining his status and his power, which was very, very precarious because he came to the throne when he was 10 years old. And the early part of his reign was marked by a whole series of attempts to overthrow him. And he was very interested in establishing hierarchy and rituals and rules. In fact, he introduced the phrase, Your Highness. He apparently introduced the handkerchief as well as a sort of form of showing your status and behaviour. Some 100 years later, talked about Richard II's court as routinely entertaining 10,000 people. Now, there may have been some exaggeration in that, but there was no doubt that he was a huge entertainer, that this was all about display. And that was very typical of the time. So we have records from 1465, so sort of 70 years later, of the Archbishop of York, George Neville. And he had a grocery list for one of his feasts, which featured 7,000 capons and 1,000 sheep. So this incredible sort of opulence and kind of scale of catering that was happening in the wealthiest households for particular occasions was pretty mind-blowing. So Richard II was known as the best and royalist vivandier. That's how he was described at the time. And in that context, these recipes record the extravagance of his court.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So, what about the recipes themselves? You might expect, I think, given how our tastes and diets have changed so radically within just 50 years, so we've gone from a nation that I don't know, eats, you know, spam and offal to one that eats sushi and vegetarian sausages now in 50 years, you might imagine that the food of 700 years ago would be almost unrecognisable. And there are dishes in the form of curry which are extraordinary and outlandish and sort of mystical, things like a porpoise porridge, roast seal, seal with sauce, heron, you know, things which are completely, you know, are off the menu for certain now. But they are the exceptions, they're not the norm. Most of the food in this document from 700 years ago is in some way very recognisable. So let me just give you an example of some of the recipes in the first 20. There's chicken in gravy, pig in sage sauce, ground beans, and cabbages in potage, which is a vegetable cabbage soup. So, you know, meat and sauce, rices like pilafs, thick soups, meat pies, very recognisable in form and content. And so one of the other things that's interesting about this document is the degree to which it is specifically English in its nature. In other words, to what degree is this particularly English food, or would this be the same sort of food that would be eaten in France, for example, at the same time, or in Spain? And there probably would have been many similarities because of the way in which flavours and tastes travelled at the time amongst the wealthy, but there is something specifically English about the variety of meats and fishes available because of this sort of island geography. So, you know, capons, pheasants, curlews, herons, partridges. I mean, basically, if it wasn't a human and it moved, it was being eaten. So incredible amounts of different sorts of fish and meats and birds. But I think the thing about the document, which for me, apart from its kind of physical majesty, that is the most extraordinary, is the way in which it is a reminder of England's long connection with the rest of the world. Because embedded in that document, in almost every single recipe, are requirement for spices or for sugar. And that tells us about this huge long cultural exchange, which started with the Crusades and then carried on with the spice trail. This incredibly complex journey that spices would have had to have taken at that time from the Middle East, you know, coming on like caravans of, you know, donkeys and camels and then across the sea, you know, travelling thousands and thousands of miles in order to get to England. So this incredibly complex links. And what that tells you then is that, first of all, the way in which the world was entwined, the way in which the Ottoman empires and Muslim empires were absolutely forming the kind of culinary culture, artistic culture, or influencing that of Europe and then England. But it also, you know, that this document is really the document of the super wealthy, because spices are entirely unnecessary. They are as useful to life as diamonds. They are the ultimate inconspicuous consumption. So the fact that they have in every recipe is a sign of total opulence. I mean, ordinary people would simply never have had the opportunity to see, taste, smell spices. The spices which are there in particular are pepper, ginger, cinnamon, cloves, nutmeg, powder force and powdered deuce, which is a strong powder and a gentle sweeter powder, which were very typical of a sort of blend, basically. I suppose the curry powder of the day. And also, interestingly, saffron features very heavily. And saffron at this time, by now, is being grown in Suffolk and in Cambridge. And at the same time, you have recipes which require rice, almond milk. So these are also ingredients which are travelling at least from southern Spain, so travelling huge distances to get to England. And then there's one other ingredient that's present in the document, but which would be something most people would never come across, and that's sugar. So a number of recipes call for sugar to sweeten and enhance dishes. Often they use sugar and salt at the same time, and there wasn't the distinction between sweet and savoury that we have now. And if I just give you a sense of how expensive or how little sugar was used at the time, we have a record from 1399 of a woman called Dame Alice Devine, who was a very wealthy aristocrat. She had a household of 200 that she was regularly feeding, and her yearly purchase of sugar was 55 pounds of sugar. This is a very wealthy woman. That equates to half a teaspoon of sugar per person per week. So in the wealthiest of households, that's the amount of sugar there was. I mean, shamefully, my children would have that, you know, on a pancake times by four every Sunday, probably. So the fact that sugar's there is a real evidence of this document's sort of record of wealth and money. What about the style of these recipes? What are they like? How do they compare to ours? Well, they're nothing like ours in that they don't have timings, they don't have quantities, none of the things that we expect now with recipes. But amazingly, those things actually came very late. Only in the 19th century did people start routinely writing down those things with recipes. But let me read out a recipe so that you can hear how they're written. This is the recipe for rice of flesh, which we're eating tonight. Take rice and wash him clean, and do him in an earthen pot with good broth, and let him seep well. Afterward, take almond milk, and do purtue, and colour it with saffron and salt, and mess it forth. So it's really more like an aid memoir. It's almost like a kind of literary description of how you would make a dish. And I think it assumes that the person reading it knows what they're doing. There's no timings, there's no quantities, there's no descriptions. So it requires, and you know, it requires you having a certain amount of knowledge ahead of actually coming into this, coming to this recipe. So that describes the, that explains how the recipes are written. What Rosie and Itamar and Sarit have done is taken six of these recipes for tonight and interpreted them based loosely on these kind of rather vague descriptions. And we are going to have these six dishes now. We have separated them out into a savoury course and a sweet course, but at the time, there would have been much less distinction between those. You'd have eaten sort of heavier foods first and lighter foods, which they might have called dessert for a second course or a third course, but a lighter dish might have meant something like a fowl pie or a roast fowl rather than beef pie. So you'd still have savoury dishes right at the end, but we've made that separation. So I hope that you get the sense of this food as being very much still connected to the ways that we eat, the flavours that we love now, and this kind of reminder of our connections with the rest of the world, that us being an island, but nevertheless, you know, always having been a global nation, and get some sense of the magic of this incredible document. What I find so exciting is that the recipes, so many of them, work so well, or that the flavour combinations work so well, but also how incredibly contemporary they seem, and also what they tell you is how sophisticated the diet was for medieval period. I mean, I think we have this idea of them being sort of like almost like savages and kind of gnawing on bones, and I just don't think, when you read this document and understand it, nothing could be further from the truth. And I think that one dish, which in a way is really very, very simple, perhaps for me encapsulates that best, and that is the recipe for salad, salat, which includes parsley, sage, green garlic, scallions, leek, spinach, borage, primroses, violets, fennel, cress, rosemary, purslane, lavender, and mint, and is served with oil, vinegar, and salt. I mean, that is just the most, for me, the most beautiful looking and the most mouth-watering, delicious salad, which would look beautiful on any table and would seem completely contemporary. And that tells me that people 700 years ago must have cared a great deal about food and what they ate, and that food was incredibly important to them. I wanted to say something about the way in which a medieval banquet would have been staged and set up, and the sort of form of eating. You may recall when I was reading out that introduction from the master cook who wrote The Form of Curry, he mentioned subtleties. And for those of you who don't know what a medieval subtlety was a sort of entertainment, often in wax or sugar or pastry form. It wasn't something edible. It was something that was brought in between courses, often to kind of entertain or to distract, often like allegorical forms, depictions from the Bible. They would have sort of like wax, huge, great big sort of wax depictions of castles or battles that had been won and fought. We have this idea that I think that kind of from movies, from Hollywood movies, you know, there's this sort of idea of banquets of people sort of throwing their food on the floor and sort of banging the table and it all being incredibly uncouth and, you know, sort of disgusting and dirty. You just have to completely forget that. That is a total myth. There are plenty of documents telling us in great detail how food should be served, the importance of etiquette following protocol. And so we know that eating, particularly in wealthy households and particularly for sort of high occasions, was something which was incredibly structured and formalised. And no wonder, in a sense, because these meals were... they were serving a number of purposes. They were, of course, as I've said, you know, they are showing the sort of opulence and status of the most important person there and of the household. But also, of course, you know, this is a highly risky time in terms of food. You have to be preparing your food carefully and cleverly and cleanly in order that people aren't all keeling over with food poisoning. There's all sorts of rituals, therefore, established in order to sort of protect and maintain both the status and the form and the safety of the people who are dining. So let me give you a sense of some of those and how this banquet would have unfolded. There would have been tables laid out in a large hall, and they would be organised in terms of status. So there would be a high table on which the most important people, guests and members of the household would sit. And then, depending on your status, the further you would be away from that table. The tables would be covered with tablecloths, at least two and probably three tablecloths. And there's something about both the luxury and the cleanliness of a tablecloth in terms of removing you from the kind of earthiness and the kind of nature of a table, as in you're literally removing yourself from the sort of wood of a table. So it's a kind of civilizing effect of the tablecloth. There would be ritual hand washing. So behind the high table, there would be a cupboard, what would be called cupboard, and there would also be another sort of sideboard with bowls of water. And before anybody sat down, people would wash their hands and clean them. And that would be very important because this is before people have forks. People are using spoons and knives to eat, but they will also be using their hands to pick up more solid food or to tear pieces of meat or put meat in their mouth. So having clean hands is very, very important. There would be, before people ate, in the wealthiest householders, ritual assays. And assays is the tasting of food by lower orders to ensure that it's not poisoned. So salt, bread would be dipped into sauces, into dishes to make sure that there's not dangerous. And that became a sort of ritual more than it was. It was a ritual that was followed more than it was something that was actually stopping people from being poisoned, as it were. And then what you would notice, I think, what we would notice if we walked into a medieval banqueting hall and we looked at the food is I think we would be struck by the incredible colour of the food, of how important colour was in terms of dishes. So they used a lot of saffron and sandalwood. They would use spinach to make things green. So you had yellow, red, green. Lots of the dishes were named after colour. So something like Blanc Desire, which became Blancmange, but Blanc Desire means white dish from Syria, Desire. So white dish, they need to have a yellow dish from Syria. So these kind of incredible colours, and particularly yellow. Yellow was seen to be like an allusion to gold. or the sun, and therefore close to God. So lots of the food would have been very beautifully coloured. So again, I think we might have an idea that that a medieval banquet would be sort of great hunks of grey meat and sort of sloppy gruel-like food. None of it at all. And then in terms of courses, they would not have the courses that we would have today. So starter, mains, puddings, that would not happen. Dishes would be brought to the table in courses, but the courses would be much more split between, salt and sweet and savoury, but it would be that you would eat the heaviest food at the beginning, and then lighter food towards the end. So things like wafers and fritters and maybe fish or fowl, rather than the heavier foods at the beginning. And there would probably be three big courses with lots of dishes would be brought. And you wouldn't get to eat everything unless you were on the high table. So if you're on the high table, you will get to enjoy the heron or the porpoise or the kind of seal, the outlandish, the peacock. You will get to try that. But people who are sort of further down the social scale, sitting at the tables to the side, will eat sort of increasingly less opulent food as you go along. So it's really... those things are really only for the sort of most honoured guests, the most prestigious people. And all leftovers would be collected together and would be given as alms to the poor after a banquet and a feast. So that will now bring us to our next course, which is a pudding course. And we'll be having a rhubarb moise, which is like a... in the form of curry, it's an apple moise, but we decided rhubarb was in season, and so we've swapped out the apple for rhubarb. And a moise, it's almost like a custard. It's delicious. And then we're also having something called a sambucard, which is in the form of curry, is an elderflower cheesecake, which just, to me, just couldn't sound any more modern and delicious.
Thanks so much for listening to our latest episode of the Honey & Co. If you'd like to join one of the next talks, please follow us on social media at Honey & Co. or go on our website, honeyandco.co.uk. We would really appreciate if you took some time and rated us at iTunes. Only 5 stars, please. With a huge thanks to Hester Kant for producing.
A special thanks to our own Louisa Cornford for her wonderful research.
And the music is by the lovely Alice Russell. Thanks for listening.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.